This is Adam Shartoff, and you're listening to FilmWax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films and AT&T. Hello, and welcome to FilmWax Radio, episode number 170. This is Adam Shartoff, your host. I don't know if this is the first time you're tuning in, or how many times you've tuned in. We have a strict policy here. If this is your first time, you have to write in. And you can write to me at adam@filmwax.com with your comments and your questions and your compliments. Not in that order. This past couple of weeks, I've probably seen as many films as I would if I went to a film festival. And some of them were actually at the New York Film Festival, but many of them were not. They were just in other circumstances. And before we get into today's guest, I kind of wanted to just touch on a few of them. And one is The Dog. It's a new documentary. It won't be out for a little while, so I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time talking about it. I'm just hoping that the filmmakers, who are Alison Berg and Frank Krodron, and I think that's how you pronounce his name, hopefully we'll have them on in the spring or sometime closer to when the movie comes out. But you may have heard about this. It's based on the guy, John Wadowitz, I think is his name. John was the real guy who Al Pacino portrayed in Dog Day Afternoon. And they followed him for, I'm not going to give away too much, but for a long period of time. A lot of people just assume he was probably in prison for many years, long since, and maybe came out not so long ago. Well, what I will tell you is that he only served a relatively short time in prison after he committed the bank robbery in Brooklyn that the film is based on, that summer afternoon of 74 or 5, whenever it was. So what I would recommend you do is sometime over the winter or in the early spring of 2014, go see Dog Day Afternoon again. And some smart programmer near you might even realize that it would be a good idea to screen it. First of all, I return to this movie all the time. I have a copy. So that's The Dog, and I enjoyed that. I saw it at the New York Film Festival. And then right after that, the same night, in fact, I saw the new Alexander Payne film, Nebraska. Now, of course, we all know Payne, who's made Sideways, and he's made, going back even further, he made Citizen Ruth, I think. Wasn't that his? And Election. But I think sort of Sideways is the touchstone. It's what kind of put him on the map. And since then, he's made a couple of other noteworthy films, including About Schmidt with Jack Nicholson, and most recently, The Descendants with George Clooney. And but this Nebraska movie is quite touching. It's been about a week or two since I've seen it now, and I will not, you know, there might be a next phase I'll move into, but I enjoyed it. And it was like, you know, when I was watching it, it was Will Forte plays the son, and of course the great Bruce Dern plays the crusty, curmudgeonly old man and his dad, and they go on a road trip. And you know, it's a very, very Payne-ian, shall we call it, movie. But it's shot in black and white. It's terrific. I was noticing now that Francis Ha, which was Noah Baumbach's film at the last New York Film Festival, shot in black and white. This year it's Alexander Payne's turn. Anyway, so that's going to be coming out shortly, and we're going to try to get Alexander Payne on this podcast. So also, I might ask you to start a letter writing campaign if I need your help with that. Yeah, that was pretty terrific. I'm going to get to the square, because next week my guests are the filmmakers behind that film. But The Square is also a very powerful documentary, and I'm going to talk more about that, I guess, yeah, next week. So maybe I won't touch on it, but I did get to see it. Then I saw Blue is the Warmest Color, which you may have heard about. It won the Palme d'Or at Cannes. Again, it's called Blue is the Warmest Color, or in French, La Vie d'Adèle. Anyway, I guess I had forgotten when I went to see it, but it was 3 hours long. Okay, so that was the first thing. If it were not for these extended scenes that were the most graphic sex scenes between the two women in this film, who are lovers, of course, they're the longest scenes I've seen like that that were not in a porno. In fact, I would say that the sex scenes in pornos are generally shorter. it was like real time watching them having sex in real time. It was, I don't want to dwell completely on it. And I think when I had Ken Turner on recently, he saw it at Toronto and he discussed it too. But they're two beautiful women. They got beautiful bodies. So for a guy like me, I guess it was, I'll say, you know, I was kind of sitting there. I went alone and I'm kind of glad I did. Because, you know, it's just, you're kind of sweating there. I had to have a cigarette after that film. But it was, it suggests that this was the first chapter of a longer story. So maybe there'll be more to the overarching story that the filmmaker, Abdellatif Kechiche, he's going to probably continue the story, maybe focusing on other characters. I'm not sure. All Is Lost is this J.C. Chandor's follow-up to A Margin Call, which came out a couple of years ago. This is the film of Robert Redford, who's out in the Indian Ocean on his yacht, and a shipping container crashes into the side of the yacht at the very, very beginning of the film, right from the very start. That's how it starts. And then from the rest of the film is Redford, without saying pretty much anything throughout the film, he basically has to keep alive and hope for rescue. So it's really a tense film. It's shot beautifully. Redford acts in this film. I've never seen a Redford in a film quite like this. And he keeps your attention the entire time. It's very true. Is there a flaw to it? Well, the controversy is the ending. And you'll just have to see it and figure it out. And figure it out for yourself. But I think you should go see it. It's beautiful. Redford's great in it. It's just an unusually good scene if you liked, if you like Cast Away, if you like Gravity. I mean, I think this movie is for you. So that one was pretty terrific. I saw that at the New York Film Festival too. Yeah. I'm getting running out of time here. I want to get into my interviews for the day. But I will say that I can't not talk about 12 Years a Slave because it too is an incredibly tense film. In fact, I did see Gravity a couple of weeks ago, and it's interesting having seen Gravity and then having saw All Is Lost and then 12 Years a Slave. It's sort of similar in the sense that all three movies are sitting at the edge of your seat, and they all do that very, very successfully. And Chiwetel Ejiofor was very, very good. But, you know, I will say one thing. Sarah Paulson, probably even better. Michael Fassbender, yeah, terrific, as always. The guy is a machine. How much dimension there was to the performance, I'm not so sure. But, you know, it's been a couple of days now since I've seen it. I liked the film a lot. It's an important film. Steve McQueen is an important filmmaker. There's no denying it. He is a voice that is singing its own song. I don't know how to send that metaphor any better, but you get my drift. When I first saw Hunger 4 or 5 years ago, I think it was at the New York Film Festival. I could be wrong. I believe it was. I was sitting in a half-empty theater, maybe two-thirds full. I can't remember. And afterwards, I just walked up to the stage and I introduced myself. And as a film fan and a geek, I just thought, this is such a special film. And this guy, who has the name of this American iconic actor by coincidence, is such a great filmmaker. And it was the first time I, you know, never really heard of him when I saw Hunger. And it was almost arbitrary because I don't know why I went to see it. But I went and I was so moved by that film and its language. I haven't felt that way in a long time. But I went up to him afterwards. I took his picture. I met him. And then, of course, I ran when Shane was at the festival. I think it was 2 years ago. Yeah, it's got to have been 2 years ago. Also, blown away. So I can't recommend 12 Years a Slave strongly enough. I think it's a tremendous film. And even though I missed the boat of getting McQueen on in time, I will work towards getting him on the show. All right. Speaking of the show, you are listening to episode number 170, and today's guests are two titans. The first one is documentary programmer Kahuna. To try to talk about Tom Powers is a difficult thing. He's a dad and a husband, but most of us who go to see a lot of documentaries And we see a lot of them as a result of his work, to be honest, because he championed many documentaries. And he's not alone, but he is one of the strong voices bringing documentaries. So he and his wife, Rafaela Nyhausen, have together created this festival here in New York City called Doc NYC. The fourth season is coming around on November 14th through the 21st. Most of the screenings are in the IFC Center, though some are also at the SVA Theater. The Doc NYC film site is up. We're going to have a link on the show page. But I know Tom well. I'm working with them this season on the festival, helping with put together their panel days. So it was a genuine pleasure to be part of the team. And I'm very excited about the festival coming up. And hopefully we'll be able to get some interviews out of it. So we'll have Tom Powers up first. And then right after that, the other guest today is Tim Blake Nelson. And you know Tim Blake Nelson, of course, from his breakout film, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? He's one of the three guys in the film, along with George Clooney and John Turturro. There's Tim Blake Nelson. And he busted out on the scene, and he's been working ever since with all the heavies. He did Syriana. He did... I like this little film he did called St. John of Las Vegas. But anyway, he just came out with a film recently called Blue Caprice. You may remember I had Ron Simons, who was the producer of the film. He came on. And so this is he was in that. He's also in another film called Adventures in the Sin Bin. It's a small comedy. It's coming out today. It's directed by a guy named Billy Federighi. I don't know. Sorry. I apologize, Billy. It's a sweet little comedy. Tim Blake Nelson is in it. He's very funny. He's also coming out in a couple of other films shortly. He's been working with that collective started by James Franco. So he's James Franco's done a few films, including one called Bukowski. He's got another one coming out, I think it just came out. It's called As I Lay Dying. Of course, it's adapted from the William Faulkner novel. And if that's not enough, he's going to be coming out in 2014 in another William Faulkner adaptation called The Sound and the Fury. Also, I think it's a James Franco deal. So anyway, I'm super excited because I really have been wanting to get more actors on, and who better than Tim Blake Nelson? And what a great guy he turned out to be. But first up here is my conversation with Tom Powers. By way of an introduction, welcome back to the podcast, Tom Powers.
Happy to be here.
Yeah. It really is kind of astonishing that it's been a full year already.
Well, this is the fourth year of Doc NYC, and I guess it feels very fresh in my mind when my wife, Rafaela Nyhausen, and I started working on it 4 years ago at the invitation of John Vanko at IFC Center. And we have a very easy way to measure it because the same year we started Doc NYC was the year we had our son. So our son continues to be as old as the festival is.
Well, right. And that's a really good way so you never forget your son's birthday.
That's right.
But you sort of have a schedule that is pockmarked almost by deadlines and by benchmarks and by, I mean, because you're involved in it, by my count, the four brick and mortar type of festival / series, right?
My calendar looks like this. I think my calendar starting in September with the Toronto Film Festival, where sure. I've programmed the documentary section for the past 8 years. And then comes Doc NYC in November, where we get to carry some stuff over from Toronto and premiere some stuff that we can talk about later. And then in March, I go to Miami for the Miami Film Festival, where I oversee their documentary section. And then for the last 2 years, Rafael and I have been doing the Montclair Film Festival in Montclair, New Jersey, where we moved 2 years ago and start a festival. And we're looking towards festival number 3 this May.
And then there's that weren't enough. There's Stranger Than Fiction.
We do Stranger Than Fiction in fall, winter, and spring on Tuesday nights at the IFC Center. Go to stfdocs.com to see that schedule. During the fall now, I teach at the School of Visual Arts. And for the last couple of years, very exciting to me, I've been programming this series on SundanceNow.com. Well, it's more like a monthly collection of films called Doc Club. So each month we pick a theme and I curate a group of docs around that theme. So right now we're talking in October. The theme is War, What Is It Good For? We've had in the past year a focus on Ross McElwee. In September we had a theme called Fix This Planet around environmental films. So you can subscribe to Doc Club on SundanceNow.com and have access to the last almost 2 years worth of films. It's over 100 great documentaries.
Well, you mentioned that November brings Doc NYC and that we're going into the fourth season. And so that's coming quickly. We're about a month off, almost to the day.
As we speak, we're about to launch the catalog and our announcement. By the time people hear this, that lineup will be known. We're speaking right now in the past.
Something I've gotten quite used to. So one thing that I like to ask, I did kind of have questions about that, how Doc NYC benefits and let's say leverages from Toronto.
Well, one thing, when I started Doc NYC with Raphael and IFC Center, one of the things that was exciting to me is that I could give another platform to the films that had launched out of Toronto. The fall for the U.S. festival calendar doesn't have a lot of opportunities to show quality documentaries. Really, the European festival calendar takes over the fall with festivals like CPH Doc in Copenhagen and IDFA in Amsterdam, one of the largest and oldest documentary festivals in the world. But in the U.S., you know, there's the New York Film Festival that is very selective about the number of documentaries it takes and the number of films it takes in general. There's places like the Camden International Film Festival, which has started up. But but there's a real opening on the calendar, and we were happy to jump into it.
What's a rough number of the films that came out of that were at Toronto that are?
Ooh, I was afraid you were going to ask me that.
Roughly, I mean,
there's five I can think of off the top of my head, and maybe I'm missing some. So,
all right, so it's not that enormous a number actually, though. But you're seeing a lot. Okay, so where are you seeing some of these? Like, we're going to get on now to maybe some of the premieres that you are doing, U.S. premieres. You have a handful, correct?
We'll
be premiering.
We have around 10 world premieres and around 10 U.S. premieres, give or take. I guess looking at data now, it tells me 11 world premieres and 10 U.S. premieres out of 132 total films and events that we're showing this year. So, I mean, some of those world premieres that come to mind is a film called Patrolman P, which investigates a case of corruption in the New York Police Department from the 1970s, very controversial case, and reopens it in Patrolman P. There's a film called Web, really beautiful film that looks at children in Peru living in remote areas who are the recipients of a laptop computer as part of the one laptop per child program. And the filmmaker follows them over several months and examines what that means to these kids' lives to get that computer. Both wonderful and complicated consequences.
Some actually almost like amusing moments throughout the web. It doesn't sound it from listening, but they have a very frustrating time. So maybe it's not so amusing, but it's where they're trying to figure out how to
you experience the growing pains of this program. It's a wonderful kind of utopian vision to give a laptop to every you know, child in the world is, would be the ultimate goal here. And this shows that in practice.
So go ahead. I'm sorry. I interrupted.
The third world premiere I was going to highlight is called Kids for Cash, which is a jaw-dropping case of corruption in a Pennsylvania court where a judge was sending an inordinate number of young people to prison, and this film gets behind why he was doing it.
As the title may suggest. What's the process? I mean, for selecting the films that are do you take these films, you've seen them, they've been submitted perhaps, or you sought them out?
Well, and this year, a huge amount of credit in this has to go to our colleague, Basil Soikas, who has a long festival history. He used to run the New Fest, the Gay and Lesbian Festival in New York City. He's an associate programmer at the Sundance Film Festival. He has a widely read blog called What Not to Dock. He has an indispensable Twitter feed at OneBasil1. And he joined us last year programming our short section and our DocCon panels. And this year he moved over to being a senior programmer for features and also doing shorts.
So he's spent obviously a lot of time out there in the docosphere.
Yes. Basil, yeah. Is a machine for watching documentaries.
Yeah. Okay. So those are some of the world premieres, and also some of these films are they just submitted cold by?
Yeah, we get a lot of submissions. Don't ask me for an exact number, but through Without a Box, and then there's some films that I see as part of the process of me looking at stuff for the Toronto Film Festival. And if it's not a good fit for Toronto, sometimes I'm able to carry it over to DocNYC. There's also some U.S. premieres. So of those films coming from the Toronto Film Festival making their U.S. premiere, I would highlight our opening night film, The Unknown Known, by Errol Morris, focusing on Donald Rumsfeld, which is a it really gets to be a film about language as they conduct a verbal duel over the meaning of recent history, which gets down to the meaning of words. And in a way, language is a theme I see popping up throughout the festival, because our closing night film, which is a world premiere of a new film by Michel Gondry about the linguist Noam Chomsky. The film is called Is the Man Who Is Tall Happy? An Animated Conversation with Noam Chomsky. What Michel Gondry did is he did these interviews with Chomsky and then make some of these complex ideas more accessible by adding his own playful drawings to them. So it was something I didn't really quite realize until we were putting the catalog together, how we're opening with a film, The Unknown Known, very much about language, and closing with a film, Michel Gondry's film, that's also very much about language, and that's about a linguist. And then once I noticed that, I could see language popping up other places. So there's a film by Chuck Workman that we showed at Toronto and are showing here called What is Cinema? And that's a film that's really about the language of cinema.
Mm-hmm. Is that more kind of a result of coincidence? Or do you think that it represents some sort of
I never know what to say about the clusters of themes that sometimes emerge, whether it's part of a zeitgeist or just happenstance.
Yeah. I mean, some of them present themselves more obviously, like war films in the last few years and that type of thing.
Sure.
Sure. Some are far more subtle in their complexity.
You know, but when you're talking about themes, there are a couple clusters of themes that emerge every year, so much so that we've formed some sections around them. So music films are always a strongly represented category. So we created a section called Sonic Cinema. And some of the films we're showing in that section this year include a couple world premieres. There's a film called Revenge of the Mekons, about one of my favorite punk bands that has endured for 40 years, making critically acclaimed, although perhaps underappreciated, music. Mm-hmm. And another world premiere in the Sonic Cinema section is called We Don't Want to Make You Dance, which Basil has described as a like the rock and roll version of Michael Apted's 7-Up series, in that the filmmaker has been following this band, a white funk band from the 1980s, who never made it big, but he's been checking in with them, much as Michael Apted checks in with his film subjects, every few years, mm-hmm. and you see the trajectory of this band.
Hmm. And then so that's the Sonic Cinema.
So that is those are two films, mm-hmm. under the Sonic Cinema section. And to add a third there, I'd highlight the film Punk Singer, about Kathleen Hanna, who is a pioneer of the Riot Girl movement and bands like Bikini Kill, and mm-hmm. and then kind of disappeared off the scene for several years, and now is making a real resurgence, including in this film Punk Singer.
Well, it's a shame you don't have a section devoted to art, you know?
But Adam, we do.
Thank goodness.
Last year we had a section devoted to photography, because mm-hmm. we had a cluster of films around photography, and it was a great way for us to partner with the International Center for Photography. But we kind of thought, well, maybe that'll happen every year, but it didn't happen this year. This year we found one terrific film about photography that would fit into that section, about the photographer Saul Leiter. But we did see a number of films that dealt with art and design in other ways. So there's the world premiere of a film called Men of the Cloth, which is about artisanal tailors practicing this centuries-old tradition that is sadly kind of going out of style.
An artisanal tailor.
Well, that is to say an old world tailor.
With the sewing machine, hunched over the sewing machine.
Exactly.
Okay. I see.
Another film that delights me in the art and design section is called Levitated Mass. This is by the documentary maker Doug Prey, who's made films like Scratch and Surfwise. And in this film, he's looking at an artist who is moving a 340-ton piece of granite rock across a great distance to be an installation at a Los Angeles museum.
Sure, that's not a Werner Herzog film?
It sounds like it, but no, this is a Doug Prey film, Levitated Mass, and it brings the kind of exquisite sense of filmmaking that Doug Prey's exhibited in his other films.
Sure.
And a third film I'd mention in the art and design section is called Magical Universe. This is a film by Jeremy Workman. So we have a film by Jeremy's father, Chuck Workman, called What is Cinema, that I mentioned before. And then his son, Jeremy Workman, has the film Magical Universe, which is about an outsider artist who makes these dioramas out of Barbie dolls. And Jeremy started making a film about this guy and then got much more deeply involved in his life. So that's worth checking out, Magical Universe. In fact, it just won an audience prize at the Woodstock Film Festival.
Oh, great. And I assume all the filmmakers are coming and other subjects in many cases.
We have over 100 documentary filmmakers coming. That includes Errol Morris and Oliver Stone and Michelle Gondry.
Oliver Stone?
And Oliver Stone is coming to
show a
prologue that was never broadcast to his series, The Untold History of the United States. This was a 10-part history that was on Showtime, a kind of radical history in the tradition of Howard Zinn.
Yeah.
But Stone had completed a prologue to it that never got broadcast, just for, I think, reasons of time. And it's going to be a rare chance to see it, and Oliver Stone is going to be there in person to present it. So, but, for people who are interested in hearing from filmmakers Also about the craft of filmmaking, I would point them towards the Docathon section, which
What's
has
that?
been expertly curated by none other than Adam Chartoff. So Docathon is panels and masterclasses that we hold over 4 days, Monday through Thursday. Each day has a different theme. So one theme is shoot your doc, another is finish your doc, another is fund your doc, and the fourth is reach your audience. So each of those days we have four panels devoted to different aspects of that theme. And people who want to get the best value for their money and take in all of that, I would encourage them to look at the Insider Pass, where for $99 you can attend everything during weekdays at the festival, from the hours of like 10 to 5. But you get to choose from over 40 films and panels with the Insider Pass.
Yeah, they really are. I think any documentary filmmaker or documentary film lover, of course, in many cases they're one and the same, but they can go to DocNYC. I encourage them to do so, and they can go to DocNYC.net to get the tickets.
That's right, DocNYC.net.
Right now.
The last thing I would plug at the festival is our section called Shortlist. This is a section of 10 films that have come out earlier this year that we think are deserving of fresh attention, and also that we're kind of betting on being strong contenders going into the award season. Mm-hmm. So they include films like Stories We Tell, and Sarah Polley, the director, is going to be here at the festival to present that film. Also, The Act of Killing and its filmmaker Joshua Oppenheimer will be at the festival. 20 Feet from Stardom with filmmaker Morgan Neville, who will present that film. Mm-hmm. So the shortlist section is the one to, for real documentary lovers, to check off their list of 10 of the best films of the year.
Yeah. So it must be hard to say no, or to get down to that level of where you have 10 films that kind
of... It is hard. I mean, we aren't saying that these are the 10 best. We're saying these are 10 of the greats.
Right. Well, again, DocNYC will be beginning on November
14th to the 21st.
To the 21st.
DocNYC takes place. And as you said before, you can get all your information at docnyc.net.
And almost the entire program will take place at the IFC Center, right?
Our two main venues are IFC Center and the School of Visual Arts Theater in Chelsea.
Well, thanks, Tom, and let's do this again.
Maybe next year.
Time. Well, for sure next year, but maybe we can talk about some other stuff before that.
Deal.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot. All right, I've been a big fan of Tim Blake Nelson's, as I said before, since O Brother, Where Art Thou? Even though he had been working for a while, I didn't know about him. But since then, I've always watched him and looked out for him and enjoyed him. So I was excited when I had this opportunity to talk to him, and I was invited up to his apartment on the Upper West Side. We were brought upstairs. He lives on the top floor. Yeah, the penthouse. He has a family, but I went up there in the middle of the afternoon, just this week. It was hot out still, like a Indian summerish sunny day. The sun was beating down. We sat out on the terrace, and we had this really nice conversation. I think originally I had 15 minutes, but we ended up sitting for nearly half an hour. He really came up to me afterwards with a big handshake and a smile, and he said, I really enjoyed talking to you. It felt good. I should have said, well, can you get me George Clooney on the show? But You know, I don't. I didn't even remember. I was then I on the way down in the elevator. I was thinking, oh, I should have had him do one of those call out things where he says, you know, you're listening to Film Wax Radio. I didn't think about it in time. I'm not good at that, you know. But I think I'm good at the interview. So here it is, my interview with Tim Blake Nelson.
You know, you're the only one of us who has a car. I mean, I live with my mom and my four sisters. How am I ever going to bring a girl home? Everything
gonna be all right. That's fantastic.
Why do you call it the sin bin? When you cheat in hockey, fuck up, whatever, they put you in the sin bin. Penalty box. A lot of people fuck in this thing.
Have you ever had sex?
Yeah.
It's wonderful.
You should come to the party, and you should bring your van.
Fine, I'm concerned about you.
Did you see that girl?
Do I even give a shit?
Whew, yeah, she doesn't matter.
Why doesn't she matter?
Because she matters, and everybody knows it. And you don't matter, and everybody knows that. The greatest man
alive. Piece of shit won't start.
If you start fucking around, I will knock your dick off.
Learn to play that thing. Sounds like a duck queefing.
0.0. Fuck are you, a narc?
Hey, thank you for coming on my podcast, Tim.
I'm happy to be here.
And it's
a reputable podcast.
Well, the podcast is. I don't know about the host, but I appreciate the compliment. So hopefully you'll get a chance to listen at some point. Although with the amount of work you do, I'm surprised you get much time for anything. You have three kids, too.
Yeah, I'd say the family is what takes up the lion's share of my time, which is a happy load of responsibility. I have a wonderful wife named Lisa and three boys, Henry, Teddy, and Eli.
Yeah.
And to be able to act in movies and write and direct movies, but also be a dad is as complete a life as I ever imagined I'd possibly have. I feel quite blessed.
And don't forget Tucker.
Oh, yes, and my dog Tucker.
I was noticing in some of my research that you kind of really hit the ground as far as your film career in the early 90s, right? And then it kind of really took a different trajectory once you did the Coen Brothers films. But before that, you had been working for good at least 10 years in regularly in film. But before that, what were you doing?
Well, I went to college, so that was 18 to 22, and then I went to grad school until I was 26.
Very good.
And then in 1990, I started acting, and I mostly did theater.
Yeah.
But was able to do enough TV and film work to sustain that. And I was pretty much always in a play year-round off-Broadway. And then I started getting more and more movies, but it was indeed really Oh Brother, Where Art Thou that
put you on the map.
Yeah, and turned what I hoped would be a career into a solid career that I reckon now will last a lifetime.
How does that feel?
It's
do you
great.
Have still perspective on that, and, you know, like 10 years later?
I certainly do have perspective on it, and I feel like I climbed up the lucky tree.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Joel and Ethan have done for a whole host of character actors right now. If you look at their body of work, they gave viable starts to Turo, Buscemi,
right.
Phil Hoffman. I think that really the only guy in our group of middle-aged character actors who didn't start out in Coen Brothers films is Paul Giamatti.
Yeah. Also, I guess Goodman, although he certainly got a boost his film career through them.
Yeah, and John Goodman's a little bit older.
Right.
I guess he's Steve's age, but I for some reason I don't throw Goodman in there, but he's certainly an example.
Yeah, well, you know more than me.
And John Polito, you know, they right. really handed careers to most of the character actors you see out there who are working regularly in films.
It's interesting because as many people as I talk to, especially with actors, you know, I understand the level of competition, and it's an industry that doesn't really rely on smarts all the time. I'm generalizing, but you know, you could be as smart as you want to be. In some cases, as talented, it doesn't mean you're going to get hired or make a film career. you know, one, as you described, that could last for a lifetime. So I understand that, that how that affects actors, but it's amazing how many I hear say they feel lucky because, you know, you work at your craft for many years.
Well, statistically, success as an actor is unlikely. It just is. And I can name dozens of off-Broadway theater actors who haven't had that opportunity to show what they can do in film. The way I did in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? The way Totoro did in Barton Fink or Miller's Crossing. Who were they given that opportunity? They would be right up there with the rest of us who are making careers out of, as character actors in movies. And so it's not just rhetoric to say you're lucky. It's true. Now, of course, you've got to show up when you get that opportunity. And you've got to succeed with it. But for the most part, those who are offered those opportunities will succeed with them, and they'll go on to have solid careers. As for intelligence and education, I'm a big proponent of both. and I think that where education comes into play is it offers you latitude and longevity. You can just do more if you know more stuff. And it means that you're more elastic as an actor. You become more clever in your choices. You become more discerning. And you're able to nuance in ways that you wouldn't if you didn't have the education or the training. So if you, I don't want to sound all fusty or like a fuddy-duddy, but if you take your education seriously, your career is simply going to last longer.
Whatever your career is.
Yeah, that's true.
By the way, Fuddy Duddy is my demographic, so don't worry about that. when it comes to things like mannerisms or affecting a dialect or something of that nature, you know, do you rely on your muscle that maybe you've grown from doing theater early on? Let's say, for instance, in this new the comedy that you've done, which takes place in the suburbs of Chicago, correct? And so you have the Chicago accent,
dialect
down to perfection.
Thanks.
I mean, maybe just a little animated so people know that you're born and bred Chicago, you know, guy, but...
Yeah, it's a strong choice anyway, and hopefully it works. I think that the ability to do dialects, and I think this is with all of us who end up playing a whole complement of disparate roles. This is true. It starts early on when you're just playing around and imitating relatives and imitating people in the regions and.
Sure.
Region in which you grow up.
Which yours is Tulsa, Oklahoma, right?
Yes, Tulsa, mm-hmm. Oklahoma, but with lots of Jewish relatives from Central Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And so I grew up imitating them and imitating our rabbi and then interviewing actually,
mm-hmm.
A lot of locals and recording their voices and trying to pick up their cadences and just doing it for fun. And then once I went to drama school, I had the opportunity to learn how to control it and focus it and work with really specific dialects and make subtle changes that in a general dialect that might specify a character. But originally it was just fun and games and not knowing I was
pretending.
Doing so at the time. Yeah, pretending, but training my ear.
Are you a musician?
I'm not. I sing a little bit. I'm raising a musician right now, and I would, watching what he does and what he puts himself through and also the talent he has, I would never, ever take on that I would never give myself that title. Absolutely not. I'm not a musician.
I guess I ask because those things often will go in hand, you know.
Perhaps if I'd practiced piano, I'd be able to play the piano, but a musician I was never going to be.
I wonder if when you get in, like a
dial it down, like for instance, the Adventures in the Sinbin, for instance, since that's one of your latest projects. Does that help? Does it help you find the character? You know, it's sort of like, it may sound strange to those, but for somebody like me, I get that actually really be a major help, just finding his voice, and then all of a sudden the rest kind of comes a lot more smoothly.
I'd say the voice is often the way in for me.
Is it?
And that's a strength I have as an actor, but it's also a weakness. Sometimes I look at my performances and feel like the voice doesn't have much to do with the body, and that I could do a much better job of unifying the two, making it feel like you're looking at a whole person,
right,
rather than what I think happens sometimes, which is that there's this voice that's detached from the rest of the physical being I'm trying to create. And I guess if I want to really work on anything in the next couple of decades as an actor, it's getting it all to come together. But yeah, I love starting with the voice and the dialect. It's a very comfortable place for me.
I know that you not only are in this new film we've been talking about, which I think is opening actually Friday.
Yeah, a couple of days.
And it'll also be on demand. But you also were recently in Blue Caprice. And it's funny, we're sitting on a terrace here. I had Ron Simons, who was a producer on Blue Caprice, and we were sitting on his terrace not that long ago, actually, talking about that film.
Yeah, I'm very proud to be a part of that movie. I think the director, Alexander Morse, and the two lead actors, Daquan Richmond and Isaiah Washington, really came together to make a great 2 hours of cinema. It's an uncompromising, unsentimental, incredibly truthful work of art. And I play a nice little role in it, along with Joey Lauren Adams, a friend of mine. But we're very much supporting players in what's absolutely Alexander Morse, the director's movie, with these two great performances from the two African-American leads.
It's a terrifying film because, you really see how someone who we kind of know in these very sort of tabloidish ways, we don't really most people don't know or get an inside window to how somebody ends up like that as a mass murderer. And here we actually do. It's like, here I understand now. I have even some compassion for, well, at least certainly the younger character. That's terrifying. That's frightening to have that kind of...
Yeah, in a weird way, it brings to mind this image from this other filmmaker with whom I've worked several times, named Finn Taylor, who talks about tone in a movie when you're really going for something delicate, which Blue Caprice weirdly does, even though the subject matter is anything but delicate. It's quite savage. It's almost as if you're trying to keep a feather aloft in the air with your breath. And Alexander Moore's, the director, accomplishes that. And you get this incredibly nuanced understanding of how the DC snipers came into being and what they were all about. And yes, in particular, the relationship between this boy and this surrogate father who finds him in the Caribbean and turns him into a cold-blooded killer. And it's a gorgeous movie.
Well said. Also, describe, you're also in As I Lay Dying. You're also in that.
Yeah.
How'd that come about?
Well, that's a Rabbit Bandini movie, which is James Franco's collective / production company. And there's a group of us that makes these movies under James's authorship and direction. And we've just finished Sound and the Fury about a week and a half ago. Actually, we finished shooting the first half of it, and we're going to come back in January and finish the rest of it. And we did As I Lay Dying. We also have Child of God and Bukowski in the can. And these are these films that James Franco puts together, often with money from his own pocket.
From his syllabus.
Yeah, from his syllabus.
Yeah.
And he completely controls the what they are, how they're made. He uses the same crew, largely the same troupe of actors. And I have, again, the word luck comes into it. I have lucked my way into that collective, and I'd go anywhere for James and do anything for him. I think he's an extraordinary force. And As I Lay Dying is a movie that's out right now based on the novel by William Faulkner.
Yeah.
And it'll also soon, I guess, be on demand. But right now it's in theaters, and it's an extraordinary work. For anybody who's read that novel, I couldn't recommend the film highly enough.
Which is, you know, always those Faulkner novels have always been considered unfilmable, as people like to say. But that must be very gratifying to have been in a successful adaptation.
Here's a Faulkner novel that has a pretty straightforward plot. And were a filmmaker to dispense with Faulkner's literary conceit of telling the story through 15 different first-person narrations and just make a movie from an omniscient point of view of what happens with this family traveling across the state of Mississippi trying to bury their mother, you could make a creditable mainstream film out of it. But James wanted to make a film that answers the literary ambitions that the novel had back in the early 30s. And so he made an experimental film, which is, I dare say, every bit as daring for being a film as what Faulkner did with the novel. Now, I'm not putting James up there with William Faulkner, nor would he, so please don't. I guess this is a podcast. Well, please don't edit the second half of this out.
Sure, no.
Which is, I'm not saying James is a talent at the level of William Faulkner. I would never say that, nor would he, obviously. But he took the road less traveled by and made an experimental film. And it's incredibly rewarding. And it really does, in the film medium, answer a lot of the challenges of the novel for the audience.
I mean, it's coming around that he's essentially an experimental filmmaker, isn't he? And,
he is, although, you know, this movie we have coming out, Bukowski, is not so experimental. That's pretty straightforward. But Sound and the Fury, that's quite experimental, as the novel was. So I'm eager to see what he's going to make out of that. A lot of these movies are, you know, end up being made in the editing room.
We don't have a ton of time left, but I just wanted to gauge a little bit of your sense of where independent film is at in a way. It's a lofty question, but it's been this ongoing story where nobody knows how we're going to see films and, you know, what the future looks like. But it seems, of course, on demand is not going anywhere. The independent film exhibition is shrinking in terms of theaters. It continues to shrink. I think your neighborhood was supposed to get an Alamo Draft House.
And I was an investor in that, and then now it seems like it's not going to happen.
I hope you get that money back.
No. Only if it's made.
I understand.
Put the theater in.
There is one or two coming, but still, in all, I mean, we need about a good handful of those. We have like a few theaters that play films that are. They're all distributed, of course, but, you know, we get these mid-sized, independent, spirited films, but, you know, not much else. And so, and even if most people around the country even aren't that lucky. And you're in a lot of those films.
I am, and I'm going to devote the rest of my life to those sorts of movies.
That's why you're on here.
I ended up on a TV show a couple years ago, and I now know that I don't want to do that. And so the answer for me is going to be to continue to go from movie to movie if I get my way, and if the movies still want me, and it'll probably be these sorts of movies, and I'm very happy about that. Look, I think that there will always be an appetite for going out and seeing a movie on a big screen in a room, dark room full of strangers with great sound, and no home movie theater system is ever going to be a substitute for that. Now, does that mean that the ancillary market of VOD is a fruitless one? No, quite the contrary. there's a huge appetite for that as well. But I don't think it's going to kill the appetite for going to movie theaters. And places like the Alamo Drafthouse and what Tim League is doing with that company and that sort of exhibition is to make going to the movies like what going to live theater used to be. It's a party. You can go and you can drink and you can have a decent meal. And you can be with a group of people with whom you come together for a collective
social
experience. Social experience. And Tim is really smart because he's making exhibition special and more special than sitting at home with 5.1 sound that you had somebody put in for your big screen TV.
I mean, if you're lucky. I mean, you know, people are watching it on their iPhones, so.
I'm all for that because all that does is to make real exhibition more special.
Mm-hmm. The contrast.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also keep people of the mind of seeing films maybe in general.
Remember also that, as I'm sure you know from the amount of interviews you do and the sorts of movies that you're watching and the changes you see in that regard, that it's just cheaper to make movies now. And so the technical apparatus has democratized the making of films. Now, I'm just about to go into... I'm in pre-production for a movie I'm making in New York right now. And because of digital photography, we're going to be able to make it at about half the price that 10 years ago I would have made it for. And if that's true about me, and I've got all these, you know, I've got a lot of actors in it and we have a lot of different locations for a far smaller scope and with far fewer locations and fewer cast members, somebody can make a movie for just several hundred thousand dollars quite easily. That's what James Franco is doing. And they're really interesting films.
And it's responsible because you're making films that will make money, hopefully. I mean, they don't necessarily always make it, but that's your goal. It's not to, you know, overextend yourself financially, screw your investors, etc. You know, so it seems like it's a model that is more responsible as well. Is it also true that with the Coen brothers, with Llewyn Davis, I think it is that their first stunt, not on film?
Yeah, that is so, digital.
Yeah. So we know if that's happened, we are certainly in the new time.
And they're editing non-linearly, too, so they don't use the Steam Deck anymore.
I see. Well, thank you very much for spending some time here. And it's a very helpful, too, with the kinds of shows I'm doing to have someone on who's so ubiquitous in the independent film world. So thanks.
You bet. Well, I hope I see you again.
Me, too. Thanks, right. Tim. All right, guys, I'm going to cut out of here pretty quick. But remember, go to iTunes, please, and subscribe to the show if you enjoyed that. The more people I get on iTunes, the more people that are subscribing and everything, I'll continue to get great guests. You know, that's all I can tell you. So thank you for listening. It's greatly appreciated. This is your host, Adam Shartoff. You've been listening to Film Wax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films and AT&T. We'll be back next week.